Welcome back to Feminist Book Club, the podcast. We're not just about feminist books. We are here for social justice, literature, and media in all its forms. But we do that through an intersectional feminist lens. Thanks for being here. Let's get started.
If a fantasy or sci-fi universe has wizards, aliens, fairies, spaceships, or whatever fictional element in it, can't it also have dark-skinned or non-binary or queer characters in it? Hey my dudes, and welcome to the Feminist Book Club podcast, the show that brings you the best of the best feminist content. I'm your host, Neba from Notes by Neba, and today we're going to talk about inclusivity in fantasy and sci-fi. How can a fictional world be real-world inclusive? This is going to be a pretty large, broad-scope view of the topic. We'll be getting into arguments for and against it, as well as how writers can incorporate diversity if they themselves have not lived that experience. This episode includes a trigger warning for discrimination, which includes racism, homophobia, transphobia, sexism. If any of these topics are difficult for you, please proceed carefully because your mental health comes first.
Today's episode is sponsored by us, Feminist Book Club, and specifically our April subscription box. Our April theme is environmental justice, and our book for the month is As Long as Grass Grows, The Indigenous Fight for Environmental Justice from Colonization to Standing Rock by Dina Gilio Whitaker. You can join us at just the book level, but our most popular option is the full subscription box. Our April boxes feature all sustainable and eco-friendly products from small woman-owned businesses, including beeswax kitchen wrap from Bee Kitchen Wrap, plant-powered vegan cookies from Empowered Cookie, a bamboo brush set from Brooklyn Made Naturals, and a roll of bamboo toilet paper from our friends at Bim Bamboo. Shipping is free in the U.S., and we'll donate 5% of your sale to our Spotlight Organization of the Month, Women's Earth Alliance. Sign up today at feministbookclub.com and click Join at the top.
So, to start off the conversation of inclusivity in fiction, I want to first examine why people might think it is not helpful to fiction. It's interesting to think that some people think authors are making political statements if they have a non-white or non-male or queer character, as if the planet, having a planet entirely populated by straight white men would be 100% realistic and not political at all. Weird. Some other people get really upset when diversity is, quote, forced, quote. But I don't know, if a story is incredible, like there's a straight up like chimera or a giant sea beast getting slayed, but a reader is upset because there's a character who's queer or a character with darker skin, that doesn't really sound like the character is detracting from the story. It sounds more like that reader has a problem. I don't understand how diversity could be forced or unrealistic when people just kind of exist. Like, for example, different sexualities have always existed in humans, so it seems kind of weird if it just never appears anywhere in a book. Of course, the world building will determine what the world's perception of it is, but it will still exist. There's no reason why a white or European people need to be the default in a fictional world. But more importantly, why would fantasy humans need to resemble any real-life races and ethnic groups, unless it's important to the story the author is telling? If the fantasy is set in a world that sort of mirrors our world, it totally makes sense. Like, for example, the Elemental Trilogy by Sherry Thomas. It should be appropriately diverse, because parts of it are set in our world. But in completely fictional worlds, I would love to see more examples where humans are diverse, but not always in the same ways we might think of. Like maybe ear shape really matters, or the length of a person's hair, or the number of gills they have, or whatever the heck social construct that universe has created. All of these are different forms of discrimination, and perhaps looking at them through some sort of fictional lens can help you kind of unpack your own ideas, help the reader understand themselves, and understand the characters in a whole new way. Looking at medieval fantasy, for example, it doesn't have to be all European-looking humans. Like in Game of Thrones, you have European-looking humans in the middle and northern part of Westeros, but then you have darker-skinned humans in southern Westeros, and then Essos has like Asian and Black and just all these different ethnicities of humans. A big question I see online is, can you have Asian people if there isn't an Asia? And obviously that extends to all races. And while you might not be able to have a Japanese person per se, authors could write in features like a darker skinned person or a person with monolids or cultural cues like kimonos. I recently finished reading The Mermaid, the Witch, and the Sea, which has a lot of Japanese culture and Black characters and an incredible storyline on sex and gender. But at the same time, it's a fantasy universe where Japan, you know, doesn't exist. But by having these little cues about kimonos and tea and the way someone looks, there still is that element of diversity. Some people argue that this is just pandering, but when your whole world is built on privilege, then equality starts feeling like oppression. White dudes get pandered to as well, and so much that they don't even notice it. I think you should just let audiences have like a badass queer Asian on a quest to unite the kingdoms or whatever the fern. Like many other readers, I would like to have, one, some interesting characters, and two, a good story. Someone being a different skin color in a fantasy setting shouldn't bother anyone. And all these things I was seeing online, it just reminded me of the joke that goes, gamers only know two genders, male and political. So let's take World of Warcraft, the massively multiplayer online role-playing game created by Blizzard. I know WoW isn't exactly literature, but it does show a really great example of why people might think inclusivity is not important for fiction, but at the same time, it sort of still is. So the WoW universe is an entirely fictional universe with no lore reason as to why Black and Asian characters wouldn't exist. Yet some people were incredibly upset when Blizzard added Black humans to the lineup, or when Blizzard revealed customizable Asian humans during a preview at BlizzCon in 2019. There's over 500 comments on just one online thread about this, filled with people being upset about this diversity. In response, one of the most popular WoW streamers of Twitch, Asmongold, he put it really well. So people were arguing that this increase in diversity was against the lore, and then he just responded, you know, Blizzard changes the lore every 2 years anyways. Someone else was criticizing that, you know, Blizzard is making this political statement, to which he responded, so what? What's the big deal? Sometimes people want to make characters that look like themselves. What's wrong with that? I just really love his such a simple answer to all of this. And a longtime WoW player and friend of mine, Sam Nguyen, said, he himself is Asian as well, he mentioned that he wanted to make his character, his human character, Asian and couldn't. And he was really sad because, unfortunately, Asian humans never actually made it into the game. The lore is made up of orcs and dwarves and elves, etc. So why couldn't there be Black or Asian characters, you know? Why can't there be a range of skin tones? Why can't there be a range of looks? When the Warcraft universe was created in 1994, I don't think they really had diversity in mind. So all humans were white Europeans. But recently, Blizzard has been trying to be more inclusive, so I think it's a pretty good first step. Maybe some people didn't like it because it didn't, you know, make sense to them lore-wise, because humans are supposed to be European-looking humans from medieval times. But then again, this is a fantasy world, so why couldn't there be different ethnicities of humans? End quote. The world of video games and literature is becoming more inclusive. And with video games, though, I think this is really important, specifically because if you're a gamer, you're oftentimes creating a character that represents you. And now, if there's customizable characters with different racial features, there's characters that are non-binary, etc., etc., it means that you can truly be yourself in this, like, fictional world. In the world of literature, if every hero is a straight, white, cis man, and every Black person is representing a slave, it's really easy to see how that would affect the way people internalize their own identities. So let's get a little bit deeper into why this all matters. Having more representation, first off, just helps to kind of normalize these concepts, and it also allows readers, who are people, you know, with our own experiences and biases, it allows people to interact with these concepts in a way that they might not be able to in the real world. And that goes for all people, marginalized and non-marginalized peoples. Some people don't really care about being represented in fiction, but when you're a brown queer girl and you're playing pretend when you're younger, then there's just no one who looks like you. It sucks. When I was younger, I really wanted to cosplay. I tried it out a little, but I never really pursued it because all I could think of was that there were no options, you know, for someone who looked like me. Young me thought, I can only be the dark-skinned person because they look like me, and if I cosplay as anything else, then my cosplay is just going to look bad. And obviously, I could have been anyone I wanted, but to many minority kids, that concept of, oh, just be whomever, is kind of difficult. I grew up in a very homophobic household and homophobic culture. In India, gay sex was only legalized 2 years ago. Before that, it was, quote, against the order of nature, quote, and it was punishable by law, it carried a life sentence. And when I started to figure out my sexuality, I had no, like, point of reference or person to look up to. I was, however, a very intense reader. Back then, I would regularly consume 3 or 5 fiction books in a week. And now I've toned it down a little. I'm at around like a book a week or something. But if I had grown up with access to young adult fiction with queer characters, you know, I may have come into my sexual identity sooner and felt safe sharing that with other people. It's just nice to see characters like you existing in the media that you like, especially when these characters are not just existing as a simple stereotype. Some people say, you know, sometimes there's a lot of fiction and a lot of literature where the race just isn't mentioned at all. And, you know, a lot of those times, I think it's still sort of implied, you know, sometimes you're not told the exact race of every character and you might get a mention instead of like, oh, sun-kissed skin or olive skin. So unless the race of a character is specifically mentioned, yes, we can imagine it to be whatever we like. Except, even though sometimes race is hardly specified, all the covers, the art, the film, the TV adaptations, all these adaptations are Caucasian looking. Even in cases when the author specifies that the, like, character isn't even Caucasian. Let's take, for example, the character Fitz in the Farseer trilogy by Robin Hobb. She explicitly wrote that Fitz is tan and the people from the region Buck are even darker, but Fitz was white, pale white, in all the covers for this book. And interesting characters means characters that aren't all the same thing, but that brings me to my next point. If you're a writer, how do you incorporate diversity if you don't have that lived experience? Online, I saw many authors that are afraid to write outside of their own race, even in secondary worlds. And there's valid concerns about cultural appropriation, and even if that's not as likely to happen in a secondary world, it's still a pretty valid concern. So I'm Indian. I like reading fantasy that features mythology from the Indian subcontinent. It's a rare fantasy that does that, but I'm excited every time. But maybe marginalized groups, you know, Indians included, were more protective of our heritage and traditions, so this could be an issue when it comes to taking liberties with portraying minority characters. You know, so the public will ask for a minority character, and then Caucasian or, you know, privileged or, you know, majority type authors will try writing these diverse characters, and then some readers get upset. There's like this general argument of like, oh, how can authors write books about a particular people if you're not one of those people and you don't understand it? And I imagine all of this is quite frustrating for authors. Like, what are they supposed to do? Are they only supposed to write from their own perspective and just be condemned for not writing enough diverse characters? Or do they write with more inclusivity and they be condemned for not fully knowing these types of people because the author is not one of them? I think ultimately, no matter what you do, there will always be critics. White writers writing non-white characters for the sake of diversity is not what we need, but we do need more inclusivity, even in fiction. Eventually, I wonder if this like problem or this kind of like the solution really falls on writers that are belonging to those cultures to portray those characters well. And therefore, the solution is perhaps to have more opportunities and more representation of marginalized writers in mainstream writing and mainstream publishing. I want to add here that Feminist Book Club does exactly that. We highlight BIPOC and marginalized writers. We use our platform as a force of equity. And even though I'm relatively new to the team, I've seen this commitment to justice both on the outside and on the inside of Feminist Book Club. Personally, I love if an author can speak to something of their own experience, but any author who writes a strong character and a strong story that is really well thought out will be an author that I read. That's my stance, at least. I'm curious as to how you as a listener feel about this. Here on Clubhouse, we'll be chatting about this, so if you want to join our discussions, we go live every Wednesday at 4:15 p.m. Pacific time, excuse me. And if you're listening to this from the podcast, just leave a comment, message our Instagram, or however you'd like to give us your thoughts. I'd love to hear them. I also have a really quick list of some inclusive fiction for you readers out there. I have books for children and adults. I have books that are just for adults. As always, the links for these are in our show notes. For books for children and adults, like I said, The Mermaid, the Witch, and the Sea was absolutely amazing inclusivity for race and gender and sex. There's also a couple series, the series Witch Boy, the series Lumberjanes, and the Tea Dragon Society by Katie O'Neill. Oh my grasses. This series was probably the best, most beautiful artwork. I just spent so long just staring at the images on this one. There's also a really great novel called Pet, which explores what choices a person can make when the society around them is entirely just in denial. For books for adults, I loved A Thousand Beginnings and Endings, edited by Ellen Oh and Elsie Chapman. It's this collection of myths from the Asian diaspora. There's some of the like biggest names in YA, and there's also like some new people. It's a mix of sci-fi and fantasy. And what I liked most of all is that each story has a short essay from the author where they talk about like the inspiration and the source. So you get this like excellent blend of being both entertained and learning at the exact same time. I'm also about to read Binti, which features a Black protagonist in a sci-fi setting, and I also just got Girls of Paper and Fire and Trail of Lightning, so I'll be spending the next few evenings curled up on pillows, drinking tea, smelling my new Feminist Book Club candle, surrounded by blankets, and if I'm lucky, surrounded by my two cats. And that is all I have for today on inclusivity in fiction. If you have a topic you'd like to discuss or a question for me, my DMs are open and you can find me on pretty much any platform, YouTube, Insta, Twitter, TikTok, at Notes by Neba.
Greetings, friends. I'm Mariquita Guerrera, and I wanted to take a moment to talk with you about My Soul Looks Back, a memoir by Jessica B. Harris, published in 2017 by Scribner. If you caught my earlier episode with Natalia, you heard us talking about whiteness and food culture. If you missed that, you don't need it for context here, but you should still check it out because we are a delight. At the end of that episode, we recommended some cookbooks to help you diversify your kitchen collection. This is kind of along those lines, but only tangentially. There are recipes at the end of each chapter, and Dr. Harris is a noted and esteemed cookbook author, having written 12 cookbooks, but this itself is not a cookbook, even if many of the discussions are centered around meals. It's a beautiful love story, an exploration of the changing nature of our relationships, and a window into a dynamic time in the life of one of the food world's exceptional writers. Plus, there are playlists for every chapter. Every chapter. It's fantastic. Dr. Harris begins her story in New York City in the 1970s when she's in her 20s. The memoir is catalyzed by the start of her romance with Samuel Clemens Floyd III, or throughout the rest of the book, Sam, a person for whom Maya Angelou wrote the poem To a Man. Harris, as she describes herself at this age, is coming into the world brilliant, but unsure of herself. At that state, where much of who you are is still so malleable, and you're learning how to fit in the world, how to make the world a place that fits you. Harris finds herself among a stunning group of writers, artists, and intellectuals, weaving in scenes of smoky, haze-filled rooms, expertly and casually made cocktails, elaborate dinners, brilliant conversations, the comfort of community, and of new relationships. Harris's timing was absolutely impeccable, and her ability to find work in areas that opened her up to rare opportunities is incredible, the incredulity of which she actually notes in an almost mirthful side comment. She gained free tickets to shows on and off Broadway as a theater reviewer, experienced international travel as a travel and culture writer for Essence, and interviewed some of the most influential Black writers and intelligentsia of our time. Sprinkled liberally within the book are encounters she had with James Baldwin, one of Sam's closest friends, finding herself at dinner parties with him and Maya Angelou, and even joining Baldwin to dine at his mother's house and growing close to his family. Harris describes first meeting Nina Simone, an introduction which began a bit confrontationally when Simone referred to her as, quote, that bitch in the red dress, unquote. But which eventually turned into an unlikely camaraderie after a chance encounter in Africa where the two were vacationing. Harris touches on gentrification, privilege, homophobia in the AIDS crisis, and racism in publishing and food media, but doesn't dive deeply into any one of these topics. This is not a story of a Black woman overcoming the odds stacked against her, but one of joy and sorrow, of love and heartbreak, of a life lived fully and spectacularly. It contains those excesses that feel even grander set against the current backdrop of pandemic isolation and stagnation. Reading My Soul Looks Back was like stepping into a place of erudite conversations and sipped wine, of sunny trips and decadent food. And I mean decadent food. There are 5 pages describing the most incredible meal in a French restaurant. I was very jealous. The book ends, as a must, with the author finding community fraying and changing as those members that comprised it grow and change, as their roles and lives imperceptibly shift, as some are lost to the AIDS crisis and some just to old age. We watch alongside Harris as our beloved icons slowly slip past us, leaving a legacy too great to be contained. And we, like Harris, remain grateful for the opportunity, no matter how tangential, to share in their lives with them. Harris's story is a true balm, a remedy for a year bereft of new experiences and easy traditions. It makes me hopeful and excited to transition back to shared meals and long nights spent among friends, doing nothing more phenomenal and earth-shattering than just passing time. And I really cannot wait. I'd wholeheartedly recommend this book to anyone that wants to draw that just a little bit closer to them right now. Once more, this is My Soul Looks Back, a memoir by Jessica B. Harris and published by Scribner. I'm Mariquita Guerrera, and you can find me on Instagram at @O_Murray. It's been a true honor to talk with you about this lovely book. We really must do it again sometime.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Feminist Book Club, the podcast. Want to be part of the club? Here's how you can join us. Obviously, subscribe to our podcast and leave a rating and review for brownie points. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and TikTok. All of those links are in the show notes. Sign up for our newsletter to be the first to know what our next monthly book pick is. And check out our award-winning monthly book subscription service. Oprah Magazine named it one of their favorite book boxes, and Shonda Rhimes called us one of her favorite subscription boxes in general. There are multiple membership levels for any budget, and it's an excellent way to support the show and the voices you heard today. See you in the club.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.